I remember the day that Tylene and I, we had our first $1 million day, like literally did $1 million of sales in a single day. Not to make people think like that happens every day. It was a very special day. Like it's, you know, a once a year type thing, but did $1 million in a single day. And, you know, our life didn't change. You know, it's like we gave each other a hug and it's like, all right, what's next?
This is Super Fast Business with James Schramko. James Schramko. Helping you build your business super fast.
James Schramko here. Welcome back to superfastbusiness.com. And I'm really excited about today's episode because we're going to go on a journey. And to go on this journey, I have brought back a friend of mine and someone who I've learned plenty from and who has also learned some things from me. Welcome, Ryan Levesque.
James, it's awesome to be back here. Really grateful and happy to be chatting again.
I love it when we do catch up because we always exchange some great ideas. And I've been tracking your journey, well, from I guess around the time you were doing close to $1 million a year to now, or even a year ago, you were on track or very close to around the $10 million per year mark. So what that's provided for me has been a great insight into some of the changes that happen as a business grows and as a brand develops. And I invited you to come along and talk about that because I think that's very instructive for other people who listen to this show. And so up front, I want to say thanks for your impending generosity.
Well, you know, listen, I'm really grateful. You have been, you know, one of the most instrumental or impactful mentors that I've had in that process. And I still remember the first time when you and I had our first call together and we were introduced by a mutual friend. And gosh, I think it was, you know, the program I had signed up for was like a 30-minute welcome call or something like that. And you just kept listening to me for like 2 hours on that first call, just me like rambling with all the thoughts going on. And that was the start of, you know, a really special relationship. You know, you were super, like I said, impactful and instrumental in helping me in this journey. So it's just cool to be able to share it with you and kind of talk a little bit about how things have changed since then.
Yeah, well, thank you. And isn't it interesting as part of the process for diagnosing and solving a challenge in the marketplace, it is good to sort of listen at the beginning and calibrate to your customer. It's pretty much what you teach with the ask method, right? Is to, you know, find out stuff before you launch in there with the solutions. So it's definitely been a part of my process coming from a sales environment where a lot of people were pushing solutions. And then I found a better technique was the more of a consultative or diagnostic approach. Now, what I admire about what you've done is you learnt this technique from somebody else and you studied this person very closely and with their permission. And you really made that idea into what it is now, which is sort of a combination. Your portfolio, if I'm correct, is you've got your own products that you're selling using your method. You've got software that supports your method. You've got information products around your method. And you've really taken that method on well past the stage that you learnt it. So you've actually developed it into more of a movement, I suppose, where you've got people in most major cities applying this to most different markets. Is that an accurate depiction of where we're at?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty accurate. I'm a big believer in, you know, so the person you're mentioning, so my mentor, one of my first mentors in business, Dr. Glenn Livingston, he was the first person that I really learned a lot of the methodology from. And I think it's true of all of us, like, right? We all have mentors, people that we've either learned from on a, like a personal basis, like you actually really know the person, and then people that we've learned from afar through the books that we've read, the courses that we've studied and things like that. And you see this in every discipline, right? From science to technology to art, everything is built upon the previous generation's ideas and thoughts. And so I think it's, number one, it's irresponsible and it's also inaccurate to mislead people into thinking that, you know, whatever brilliant idea you've had or success that you've had is your own doing. It's the sum total of everyone who came before you, who blazed the trail, who created the path, and then whose discoveries and ideas led to what it is that you've created. So yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. And I'd say, you know, I mentioned you, I mentioned Glenn. I think there are a lot of people who have had a big impact in my life to help make that possible.
You've been excellent at assimilating information from people and turning that into your own thing with a unique sort of branding or personality. There is a great video, I'll link to it from the show notes. It's like, I think it's called Everything is a Remix, but it's pretty cool. And certainly you can lend things from the music industry, like the four chords that pretty much drive almost every song. The way that you've done it is excellent. And one thing that struck me when I was coaching you is how driven you are. You have this inner fire. You've got a deadly combination of technical understanding, which some people call geeky, but you've got technical capacity, but you also have a very strong determination and resolve. Did you always know that you wanted a $10 million per year revenue business?
Oh, it's so funny. You know, it's total opposite. When I first got into this world, right, the world that we're in, this the online business world, selling training and information programs and things like that, like you, I was in a corporate job. I worked for a big company. I didn't even know that this world existed. And my big goal at the time was, I said, if I could make $10,000 a month in passive income, right, where I didn't have to show up to an office, it was just money that came in while you sleep, so to speak, like, why would I want to work another day of my life? Like, that was it. Like, that was the sum total. Like, it's like, if I could get there, I'd be done. I'll retire. I'll be, you know, 25 years old, 28 years old, whatever I was at the time. I'll retire. I'll never work another day of my life, and I'll just live on that $10,000 a month. And what ends up happening, you know, and I don't know if this is true for everybody. For me, certainly, it's, you know, that $10,000 a month, you hit it, and it's like, okay, great. Now it's $20,000 a month, and then it's $1 million a year. I remember the day that Tylene and I, we had our first $1 million day, like literally did $1 million of sales in a single day. Not to make people think like that happens every day. It was a very special day. Like, it's, you know, a once a year type thing, but did $1 million in a single day. And, you know, our life didn't change. You know, it's like we gave each other a hug and say, all right, what's next? A mentor of mine likes to say, new level, new devil. And really what that means is you get to a new level and there's always something. The horizon is always moving ahead. So for me, yeah, I think I'm pretty intrinsically driven, you know, just very self-competitive. My thing that I've realized, and I think this is true for people who resonate with what I teach, is there are a lot of, I think, experts or educators out there who create sort of freedom as the ultimate goal. I know it's a big part of your life, right? Having the freedom to be able to go surfing and live that life and have everything. And I think freedom's super important. For me, what I've realized, the drug that is more powerful than freedom for me is momentum. When I have momentum in my life, when I feel like I'm moving forward, when I feel like the accelerator is pushing me forward, I feel like I could take over the world. Like, it feels like it's the most amazing feeling in the world. Freedom for me is fleeting. Like, it comes and it goes. Like, I'll have moments of freedom. But if I have constant momentum, constant progress, constant moving forward, like, that drug makes me feel better than anything else. And so I seek that out. I seek out, okay, where am I going to get momentum? And it can be in different dimensions. It doesn't have to just be in business. It can be in health and fitness and things like that. But I realize I need that in my life to feel fulfilled. Like, I'm making progress and have momentum in, you know, whatever challenges I'm trying to solve.
Yeah, I think it's that drug that makes you send so many emails in a single day. I work with quite a lot of people and I do see it. You are like a, I know it's like in a nice way, but you're like a very driven person. And I think it causes you to operate, you know, to get that release, to get that feeling. And you said it so well, actually, that I like that saying, new level, new devil. The $10 million revenue is a very common stated goal for people when I start my diagnostic at high level coaching, especially seven Yep. figure entrepreneurs. And I do question that. Why? You know, why is this important? What will change in your life when you go to $10 million a year in revenue from $4 million a year in revenue? Because most business owners are making at least $1 million profit, right, even at $4 million a year revenue. So there has to be something else. And, you know, you found your one. And I imagine, it's probably also ties into your hobby of Lego. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. And
you nailed definitely it. Would, you nailed it.
I wouldn't put an S on it or stick it in lowercase or anything, but maybe you like to build and create and, you know, imagine different ways that things can be rearranged, and it sort of flows through into your work. So, you know, a little bit tongue in cheek there, but I wanted to know, do you have to do things in business that feel uncomfortable to you at times? You know, for me as a business owner, I don't get as caught up in the competitiveness of, say, product launches.
Right.
That's a deterrent for me,
right,
because it doesn't feel right. But for you on your drive and with the peer group, the company that you keep, that's more the norm. Do you enjoy those things? Are there things that you do that you don't love from time to time?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, gosh, I wish I could say, listen, you're the boss. You get to call the shots. You can make your own rules. And to some extent, that's true, right? And, you know, of course you can get to a point where you're going to just say, you know what, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to make my own rules. But when you do that, there are consequences, right? You know, small examples. I see people who, you know, say, I'm going to shun social media. I'm off Facebook. I'm going to leave Facebook. In more cases than not, I can't tell you how many people that I've come through that circle in my life, they leave Facebook. They're not going to be on there. And then a year later, they're back, right? Because that's where the rest of the world is. And so, yeah, there's a price associated with it. You're just not, you're going to lose contact with all human beings that you know. And so if you're prepared to do that, fine. But sometimes it's not all cracked up, you know, what you might think it might be. And so I think there.
Well, the grass, what is it? The grass on the other side still needs mowing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, so a couple examples, you know, gosh, do I wish we could send one email out and everybody would come flooding to do the thing and buy the thing and do whatever, you know, we're encouraging people to do? Of course, I'd love to be able to do that. But what I've also learned is we just did a 4-day holiday sale. Every email that we sent out, you know, generated an additional, I don't know, $40,000, $50,000 in revenue, right? So, you know, you have critics that'll say, oh, you're sending out too many emails. But then on the flip side of it, what I've learned to believe in is, listen, if you believe in your products, if you believe in what it is that you're selling, you have a duty, you have a responsibility to get that into the hands of other people. Because here's the deal. There's someone out there that didn't check their email in time, and they're not going to get access to the product. They're going to go to some second-class expert who doesn't know what the hell they're talking about. They're going to follow crappy advice, and they're going to spin their wheels for another 6 months. I can't tell you how many people come in my world and they say, Ryan, do you know how much money I've invested in programs and how much I wish I would have found what it is that you're teaching like 5 years ago? So when you hear stories like that, and I'm sure you hear it all the time, people who come to you and are like, gosh, James, everything that you say like makes sense. Like you're telling the truth. Like I believe you. Thank you so much for everything that you do. I wish I would have found you 3 years ago because I just had all this pain and suffering and, you know, struggle and money wasted and everything like that. So there's a flip side to every coin because I get it. Like I get, you know, what the critics might say, you know, pushing too hard, marketing too hard. But on the other side, you know, there's another side to that story.
Yeah, I think it's a good one. I actually made a video about this. You'll laugh at this one, but I made a video talking about people's reluctance to send an email to their customer base. Here's my major point on this. It really has to come around to context. Did people ask to be communicated with, and is it relevant to what they've asked for? And that's, you know, it's super ironic because of what you do. And one of my customers sent out an email to his customers, and he sent 4 emails over 5 or 6 days and got 66 new members to his membership because the people on his email list had not been hearing from him and they wanted to hear from him.
Right.
And the difference there is, I know there's people who believe in their product and think it's the greatest. I had someone knocking on my door just the other day while I was recording a podcast. And when I went to attend what I thought might have been a courier, it was someone spreading the good word of one religion or another. Not exactly sure which one, but they were very passionate about their product.
Yeah.
But I wasn't that passionate about receiving that information at the time.
Right.
So it was unwelcomed or unwanted. In fact, the only people to stick flyers in our no canvassing, no junk mail is the same organization,
yeah,
which cracks me up. So where do people, you know, how far should they be segmenting that relevance? You know, how explicit a permission would you need when you're communicating the message if you are very zealous about your product?
Right. Yeah. You know, so there's a couple, I think, universal best practices. And then there are others that require a little bit more nuance. And, you know, the answer is it depends, but we can talk about some kind of rules and guidelines that I find to be helpful. So number one, one of the things that we do is every month we look at our engaged subscribers and we go through a list hygiene and re-engagement process. So what that means is simply every 30 days, you should consider taking a look at your email list, and everybody who has not opened or clicked on an email in the last 90 days, doing this every 30 days, should either be removed from your list completely, or they should go through a reactivation process to say, hey, do you still want to be subscribed to this? Do you still want to hear these messages and so on and so forth? And if so, you know, you bring them back onto your main list. And if they don't respond, then you just, you know, it's as painful as it is. You say, all right, time to move on. because people's, you know, they might get sick of you, their interests might change, they may no longer be in the market for whatever it is that you're selling. And ultimately, it's dead weight that you're carrying. And there's a high carrying cost to that dead weight, not only just in paying for, you know, an email list that is unresponsive, and you're, you know, every single month with your Entreport or Infusionsoft or Drip or whatever ActiveCampaign, whatever service you use, you're paying that bill every single month. But number two, it also drags down your deliverability and your open rates and click-through rates across your entire list, because the ISPs of the world, the Gmails, the Hotmails, are looking at it and saying, all right, well, you're not paying attention to the engagement of your subscribers, so we're not going to deliver your stuff to a primary inbox. We're going to send it to a promotions tab or spam folder or whatever instead. So there's a real kind of business argument for why you want to engage in what's really just good human-to-human like relationship practices. So that's kind of one that's like a general universal rule that I think can apply to every business when it comes to segmenting at a mass scale. Beyond that, one of the things that we do, it's a hallmark to the process that I teach, is to segment on the front end of your acquisition funnels. And basically what that means is when someone opts into your email list or they visit your website for the first time, you want to identify a few pieces of information about that person so you can send them more relevant emails, more relevant offers, more relevant content. So that's kind of phase one. Phase two is periodically along the way, you want to go through that process again because people's lives change, right? So someone who might be in the early stages of their business, you know, 6 months ago, you know, 6 months later, like they have a fledgling business. They're no longer, they've graduated from that stage. And so the type of communication you send to them is something that, you know, probably needs to change and needs to be a little bit different. So, I mean, we could talk, gosh, we could do a whole masterclass on segment, but those are a few examples of ways to consider segmenting.
They were excellent ones. I mean, the friend who introduced us, Andre Chaperon's very good about this. He asks people if they'd like to hear more information about a particular campaign. And if people opt in, then they go into that segment. And if they don't, then he leaves them alone. But like you, we clean our list very regularly to keep our reputation high, and our list hygiene is even more important now with the changes that Absolutely. Are going on with privacy and data collection around the world. So just, I'm curious, and I'm not sure if it's a number you're keen to share, but what sort of size email list is a business accumulating when they're at your level of scale?
Yeah, you know, so it's a great question. And I think what's interesting is our email list is probably smaller than I would say other email lists in comparably sized companies from a revenue standpoint for a few reasons. So number one, it has to do with the niche that you're in, right? So I've been involved in companies, you know, before I built the Ask Method company and Bucket.io, our software company, I was involved in 23 different markets. So I had the opportunity to have my hands in 23 different businesses. And the relationships I had were everything from 100% ownership in those businesses to partnerships to paid a revenue share on a revenue share partner basis. So, but what it did give me was a look into the size to these different companies. And so in the health space, right, weight loss and health nutrition and things like this, $10 million company has an email list of literally millions of people. Right? You know, 2 million, 3 million people on an email list. And the reason for that is it's a mass market consumer space. The value of one of those email subscribers is measured in, you know, dollars per month, not tens of dollars per month, just based on the fact that you're selling probably, you know, $27 ebook on how to lose weight, right? So you need a lot of people to get to $10 million to do that. On the total flip side of the equation, one of the businesses I had involvement in was in the business funding space. That was a business that had a relatively small email list because the entire email list was customers, people who were actually applying, who had applied for business funding, and they were doing, you know, business funding deals that were hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? So you don't need a whole lot of those customers. You know, so for us, we're somewhere in between. We're in a B2C space, but we're in a B2B space, but it has more of a B2C feel to it because we're selling typically to the entrepreneur themselves, like the head of the company, as opposed to, you know, VP of marketing at a larger company. You know, so for us, we're kind of in between those two extremes. A business our size in that type of space, our email list is in the hundreds of thousands of people. So not tens of thousands, not millions, hundreds of thousands. You know, that fluctuates up and down as we engage in new campaigns and clean our lists and all that good stuff.
Yeah, thank you. That was good. If I was going to guess, I would have guessed somewhere around 600 to 900,000 emails based on the types of customers I've seen. I do want to encourage someone listening to this, though. You do not need a massive list, as I'm sure Ryan didn't have a big list when he was just making $1 million a year or $2 million a year. even in my own business, we have a tiny, tiny list. We just have a very dedicated list. But I think it's funny, you know, in the age of Facebook Lives and many chats and remarketing, that we're talking about emails, because I still think email's important. Do you still think email's important, Ryan?
I literally just had a call that I did with some of our partners in a couple of different areas earlier today, and talking about this exact same subject, and that there's so many shiny object channels that are out there. And year after year, email is kind of like the reliable. It's like, it just reminds me of my parents. They drive a Toyota 4Runner, mm-hmm. which is like a kind of SUV. It's on a truck chassis. You're probably familiar with it, right?
Yeah.
So it's on a truck body. And they live in the bitter cold of northern New Hampshire, where it snows, you know, 10 feet a year. And it just, they live on the side of a mountain, and you need four-wheel drive just to get to the house and everything like that. You know, and the car is in great shape. It's like incredibly great shape. The car is 21 years old. I remember they bought it new when I was like still living at home. And they still have the damn thing. It's their main car, and it has hundreds of thousands of miles. And I see all the neighbors where I grew up always getting new cars every couple of years. And they've had the same thing for 21 years. And it just works better than anything else. It doesn't break down. Toyota does an amazing job with the underbody of the vehicle. It doesn't rust. They have like no problems with the engine. It just keeps on going. And email just reminds me, it's not sexy. Right? It's not like the new Range Rover that just came out. You know, it's not the sexy SUV that's coming out, but it's the thing that just keeps producing year after year. And it's kind of like a very blue collar, salt of the earth channel that just keeps going. And it doesn't create headlines, but it's still, for most people that I talk to, it's still quietly the backbone of their business, despite not getting the headlines of Facebook Lives and, you know, Instagram and Pinterest and all the newer stuff that's even newer than that, that people are starting to jump on right now.
Yeah. And you know, just the core things. I know it's part of your model mix now, as you've been dialing in events. You know, events have been going on for quite some time in society. And combining them with an information product or combining them with a software product for a user convention is very clever. How has that changed the way that people are reacting to your business when you run events and have several hundred people to the big one and 100 or so at the smaller one? How has that reaction gone?
Yeah, I mean, I have this phrase that I share with our students, and I say, listen, the clicks may give you cash, but it's the miles that make you millions. And that's true whether you are a producer of events or you are a attendee of events. And what I mean by that is most of us got into this world, at least I can speak for myself, at least part of the reason why we got into this world is so we could hide behind a computer screen, do some work on the computer, and have money come out of it, right? Without having to interact with people in the regular world. For me, the thing that I was like burnt out with is I was in a corporate job. I had a team of like 24 people that were reporting to me, and I was just playing like daddy. Like they were having so many politics and just this person did this to me. And I was just so fed up with having to manage all these people. My thing is like, if I could just create a machine that produced cash and I wouldn't have to talk to anybody and I could just be in a room and do my own thing, that's the dream. I think a lot of us are attracted to selling information products and building an online business, at least in part, so we can kind of work from home and have our freedom and our independence and all that good stuff.
And surf.
Yeah, and surf. Exactly. Play Lego like whenever you want. We all have our reasons. And so, yeah, for the longest time, I didn't do events. But what I realized is that's where the real magic happens. When I started attending events after I'd been in this business a couple of years, that's where I still have friendships and relationships with people that I met at events, gosh, 6-7 years ago. We're still friends. You know, we still do business together. Some of them are clients. And when you're hosting events yourself, whether it's a small event, we just hosted a small event, 20 people came to our office. I worked with them to build out their list building campaign. They actually came here to our office. So we do small things like that. Mm-hmm. For me, like that level of human connection is what continues to make it real.
Yeah.
And what happens is, and you've experienced this because you've been doing this for a long time.
You know, I think about the Maldives, like if you're on a boat with 10 people for a week, imagine, you know, you're eating four meals a day, spending 5 or 6 hours in the water, chatting around the lounge. Like imagine the connection you can make over a week in such a small group, hanging around on a beanbag, chatting about business. It's just so deep. I like that.
Totally. It's great. And it's for me, I'm, believe it or not, more of an introvert. Like I'd like to kind of do my own thing. I'm pretty introverted. But I do need these times where, even for me, they refuel me when I go out. Now I can visualize who my customers are right here, right now, so I can better serve them on a mass scale. And if you distance yourself too much from your customers and don't have these experiences, as you progress in whatever field you're helping people with, there will be more and more distance between where you are now and where your customer is right now. And you constantly need to fight to close that gap, because otherwise you run into the ivory tower syndrome, mm-hmm. right? Where you are in your own little world and your world is so different, so far removed, and you forget. Like, you forget where you were when you were leaving Mercedes and you had your little business that you had started when you were moonlighting. Like, you have to constantly bring yourself back to that moment in time, because that's where your customers are. You know, for you, they may be a few steps ahead of that, but...
Yeah, or you move the entry point to where your customers start is one, sure. one handy trick. I screened out with my starting point, and actually, I remember sitting here in the hotel in Manly when you came and spoke at my live event, which is exactly what we're talking about, traveling. You know, you definitely put in the miles and the whole family as well. And we're talking about that front-end chooser and segmenting people by where they're at in business, and that extra step that I added to the challenge that I'd had there. So I have a two-step front-end quiz funnel, if you like. That made a big difference as to not even showing my offer to people who were at that stage where they're just moonlighting in the job. And so one way to take advantage of that change is to just keep moving the bar up a little bit on where you start customers. But you are so right. Some people get so successful, they're on a different server, they're using different tools, they have a team, and their customers have none of these things in there. And the gap is so wide that it can become difficult to be relatable.
Totally. Totally, totally. I mean, and it's true in any field. If you're in fitness, same thing. You walk in and you've got 4% body fat and you've got a perfect physique, and then your customers are coming in and they haven't worked out in a gym in 10 years. You know, there's a huge gap. And it's true for any discipline, any space where you're helping people achieve a transformation. So I think live events are a place to close that gap, create real human connection. And I think, you know, it helps with your empathy. It helps with your understanding. There are just so many benefits to doing live events that I'd encourage anyone, no matter what type of business you're in, to find some way to connect with your customers in person at least several times a year.
Yeah, fantastic. I want to ask you a question about your schedule. As the CEO and founder of these business units that you have, which is predominantly information products and software, where are you spending your time in a week? And does your calendar still look as scary as the time I saw it once?
You know, it's, yeah, it's funny. I remember there's a, yeah, there's that week where I was trying to schedule something, or I shared it in something, and you gave me a bunch of crap for saying, wait, you have to schedule time for when you're spending time with your kids. And, you know, I'm looking at my calendar right now. And the reason why I put that time in, not because I have to be reminded of it, for me, it makes it a priority above everything else. It's the first thing that gets scheduled. And so when I look at my calendar right now, you know, there's a fair amount of meetings. What I typically try to do this, so I'll give you like a week in the life example. So week in the life, I look at like a couple weeks ahead, what's going on, because I've got some travel coming up that's a little bit unusual. So I'll do like on a Monday mornings, we have nothing scheduled, no meeting scheduled. Monday is kind of like get a start to the week. And then Monday afternoon is when I have my management team meeting. That's where my senior management team and I, we meet and we cover the strategic elements that we need to cover in our business. Each person on that meeting manages a department, right? So I have my head of marketing, head of technology, my COO, who basically runs the day-to-day operations of the business. I have my director of content and products and a few other members on that team. And so they each have their departments and they have their weekly meetings that they run. So that's kind of my Mondays. That's typically all that I have on Mondays. Monday's kind of like a catch-up day. Tuesdays and Wednesdays are kind of the days when I'll have a few company meetings. Thursdays I keep open for when I'm doing a webinar or training or something like that. And I only have a retrospective Friday morning with my COO, where we kind of do a retrospective on the week, talk about what's coming up the following week. And that helps set the stage for a management meeting on the following Monday. Otherwise, I keep Fridays pretty open. A couple things I do, I work out 5 days a week. And that's like kind of non-negotiable. I work out in the mornings. I have a weekly massage that I treat myself to on Friday afternoon. That's like a non-negotiable. That's how I segue from the work week into family time over the weekend. I'm pretty much done like with my commitments around 4 o'clock, no later than 5. So from 5 to 8 is family time each day. And then I'll usually do a little bit of work, light work at night when I'm, you know, watching TV or just catching up on something. I work well at that time when the house is kind of quiet. It's kind of my weekly schedule.
That was pretty insightful because you also sort of revealed some of the people who are in your team. And that's been a big part of the growth when you reach that point that you realize you can't actually do everything yourself. Was that difficult for you, or was it a relief?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's still a transition. So like, I think when you first get into business, right, it's just you, like you're it. It's you. And eventually you go onto Fiverr or Upwork and you get a few little contractors to help you with various tasks. And then maybe you hire your first employee or your first main person who's working with you either full time or on a part time basis. And it's usually like an assistant type role, right? And they do kind of a bunch of different things. So that's kind of like phase one. And then that kind of morphs into you as the hub with all these spokes around you and everything. You're the one connection point. And if you were to step out of the business, like everything would kind of fall apart because everything is connected to you in some way. That's kind of the next step. Then you get to a place where you have kind of heads of areas of what you're doing. And they're able to take a little bit more responsibility. They're a little bit more independent. And eventually they have little assistants, helpers around them. And then you get to a point, which is where we are now, where as the visionary founder, entrepreneur of your business, nobody reports to you. And instead, you are like the moon orbiting the planet of your company. And that's kind of where I am. I'm very fortunate to have a partner, a COO, who's an integrator. You met Richard when we were together in Austin last time that you came to Austin.
That was a great event in Austin. My next call after this is with someone I met in Austin. And then my call later on is, and another person I met there connected me to someone else.
Oh, awesome.
That was a good event.
That's great. Yeah. We still talk about that one.
Yes, I did meet Richard.
Yeah. So Richard runs the day-to-day operations of the company. And so everyone reports into him. So what it's allowed me to do, just to give you a glimpse into when you're at this stage of your business, is there are pros and cons. Ton of pressure on me, right? At the end of the day, I'm responsible for their 50, give or take, and just like your company, 50, give or take, lives whose livelihood is dependent on, you know, they have jobs. Like they put food on the table for their families based on the work they're doing for my company. So I have a huge responsibility and I don't take that lightly. I take that extremely seriously. So there's a lot of pressure from that standpoint, but there's also relief as well because I'm not the one who's, I don't have people reporting into me. Instead, what I'm able to do is spend my time on the things that I want to spend time on and where I can add the most value. And those are being the face of the company, being the face of all the training programs that we put together, any of the marketing videos, anything like that. I get to be the face. I also get to focus on strategic thinking, being, you know, blazing the trail a mile ahead of where everybody else is on the team. So because I'm not encumbered by people who are dependent on me, I can run a mile ahead, figuratively, and take a look at what we're going to do next. While they're all working in the present, I get to spend time in the future and plan on what are our new products? What are the threats that are approaching us? What are the strategic partnerships that we want to develop? All those types of things and kind of work in the future, come back from the future into the present, say, hey guys, here's what we're going to be doing now, and then go back and do that kind of trip back and forth. So because I don't have anyone reporting to me, I don't have, like in my case, one-on-one meetings with everyone on my staff. You know, I'm not dealing with vacation time and time off and things like that. Like I'm able to do what I'm very good at. I'm not good at those other things. I'm not a good operator. And I'm very fortunate to partner with someone who is an excellent operator and is terrible at all the other things. And Richard will admit he's not an ideas guy. He's never had an original idea in his life, but he can take one of the ideas that I have and he can execute it extremely well. And so the credit that I'll give there is to the model called Rocket Fuel, which was a phrase in this context coined by Gino Wickman. And he's the author of a book called Rocket Fuel, which introduces this integrator visionary framework, which if you're an entrepreneur, chances are you fall into one of those two camps. You're either an excellent operator, integrator, or you're an excellent visionary. And the way you grow your business is to consider partnering with someone who is the opposite of you. And the whole premise behind this book and this framework is that all great companies that have ever been built haven't had a one person at the top. They've always had two. Typically, you only hear of one because they're the face of the company and it makes it seem like they're the one responsible for all the growth. But the reality is there's someone behind the scenes, and every company from Microsoft to McDonald's to Apple has fit this dynamic. So
nice. And I'm sure there's times when it doesn't run smoothly. And
every day.
It's funny, sort of at a business at a level like mine, like I can purely relate to what you're talking about, because when we had 65 people in our business in an SEO business and website development, we had department managers and the teams were reporting to them. And, you know, life was pretty straightforward from where I sat. And now that we've scaled to a point where we have around about five people in our team, it's about the same workload, but a lot less pressure or responsibility.
Right.
Because, you know, we're a very profitable, smallish business. And that's really the fun of this discussion of going behind the scenes. It's like you get to slide the scale and decide where do you want to be. And I'm very pleased to hear that you're still into the fitness and the gym and that you are blocking time for the family, because sometimes those things fall by the wayside in a pursuit, or I'd say a blind pursuit of just chasing revenue.
Totally.
I did want to ask you about software. If you could summarize your experience going into a software realm in a few sentences, what would that look like?
You know, software is a totally different animal than selling, you know, training. Information and expertise is how we define it, right? So coaching programs, masterminds, online courses, membership sites. And the reason for that is, so I, on the Ask Company side of things, I'm largely, and I put this in air quotes, the talent, right? So ideas come out of my brain, we produce those into courses, and I have a lot of influence over that. On the software side of things, I am the least talented person on the team. I cannot code anything. So for me to bring an idea to the team, it's very different. On the Ask Company side, we can say, hey, we're going to produce a course, which we've just started working on and on putting the finishing touches on webinars, how to do segmented webinars in a way that we've never taught before. So that's easy for me to impact directly. On the software side, I say, all right, we want Bucket to be able to produce segmented webinars in the funnel flow. So we have the ability to create segmented webinars based on the technology in Bucket. In order for that to happen, I can't just say, okay, here's what it needs to look like. I need to use words to communicate to our UX UI designer what that looks like. It'll come back and I'll say, did you listen to what I was saying? Because the way I described that, at least in my mind, was very different than the way it came out. And so there's a long back and forth conversation around that. So the process is very much taking something from idea to reality is a very different and, for me, more challenging process, because I don't have the ability, the skill to just say, you know what, move over, let me just code it up real quick. Boom, 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 boom. This is what I was trying to describe. I can't do that. So it's much more of a team effort. So that's like the first dynamic that's very, very different. Second dynamic that's really interesting is it's given me a lot more empathy for software companies. And here's the reason why. And you may experience this in your business, James, because like I'm the face of the Ask Method company. Some people are total jerks, but mostly people are like, they're gentle. They know there's a human being behind it. They know we're trying our best. If we mess up on something, by any stretch of the imagination, we're not perfect and we make a ton of mistakes, but we're working to do the right thing, you know, wherever possible. And I think because people see there's a face behind that, they're a lot more forgiving and honestly respectful toward our brand. On the software side of things, the things that people say, I cannot repeat. It's as if customers, and I've been guilty of this myself, so I'm not going to say that I'm a saint, you know, get so furious with the technology and forget that they're actual real human beings that are like right behind it. They're one layer removed. They have kids that they go home to every single night. They were, you know, they're sons and daughters of parents that are probably the same age as maybe your parents listening to this right now. Like, they're human beings. And yet the way some people just, you know, just the level of respect speaking about a software product versus speaking about a human product is just like night and day. And so for me, it's helped me check my own behavior when I get frustrated with some of the software we use in our business. And, you know, when my initial inclination is to be like, your software is garbage, like you've killed our business, what the hell's wrong with you? I take a step back and say, all right, there are good human beings behind this. They're trying their best. Let me talk or communicate with these people like they're humans, not like there's like a team of robots in a factory writing code.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Keyboard warriors can be frightening. Lack of empathy.
Exactly. There's so many differences. There's so many similarities for sure. But building a product-based business that's independent of any human as a like the face or the expert is it's a longer process for sure. It's definitely one for anyone who's, you know, enamored with the idea of building software. It's by far a much longer road. Like, you have to have the long game in mind, because it's going to take you more time than you expect. It's going to take a lot more money than you expect it's going to take. And you're never finished, right? There's no like, you put a bow on it, it's done.
Yeah. And I think you, like, even if you're Facebook or Google, it feels to me like at any moment, a competitor could come along and just steamroll you. Like, you know, we've seen with quite a lot of technology companies, they're only as good as they are now. Like,
right.
There used to be Google Video, for example, and, you know, YouTube sort of drowned it, even though it's owned by the same company. But you've got to stay sharp.
You totally do. it's this delicate balance that you're trying to maintain where you're listening to what your customers are saying. And at the same time, if you don't put that through some sort of filter and through your own strategic planning, what'll end up happening is you're going to be like the guy who's pulled in 17 different directions and, you know,
Frankenstein product.
Yeah, Frankenstein product, and you're not going to get anywhere.
And some software companies change so much they don't even know what they are at the end and who they serve. And you see people, software companies in particular, they're often repositioning or regrouping what their suite of tools are.
Exactly.
Because things change.
Totally.
What are you most excited about at the moment in business at this point in the year? We're about halfway through the year. Is there something on your mind that you're passionate about or interested in?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of new projects on the table right now. One of the ones that I'm most excited about is I have a new book that's coming out. It's the prequel to my first book, Ask. And it's, in a nutshell, in Ask, I shared how I entered 23 different markets. And the process I used to do that, which is the come to be known as the ASK method. And it's all the surveys and segmenting that we've been talking about. But what I didn't share in that book was how I chose those 23 markets in the first place. And I have an equally methodical quantitative process that I developed over years for identifying market opportunities that were ones worth pursuing. And that's what the book is all about. The book is called Choose. It'll be coming out in early 2019. And I've been working hard on that and really excited to introduce that to the world because I think it's going to help a lot of people who are, at least in my world, who were attracted to ask, attracted to this idea, followed all the steps and still didn't get results because they failed to make the single most important decision you need to make in business, which is who you're going to serve, because that can be the difference between success and failure.
Yeah, that sounds like a great book. That's a great book. It's like my book's almost a prequel to that book. It's like, you know, getting yourself sorted so that you can have capacity to implement this stuff. I do get asked all the time about market, which market to go into. And I've actually purposely avoided raw startups because, you know, like you said, you could do everything right,
right,
and still not get a result. And it could be just down to the market you've chosen or the audience you're serving. So I'm looking forward to reading that book. Thank you for serving the world with that one. And will you have a similar structure, Ryan?
Yeah, so that's
half story, half technical. Are you going to blend it up a bit?
The great part about being a first-time author is you're only a first-time author once. And so you could take all the feedback that people barbecue you over on Amazon and incorporate that into your next book. So short answer is story and technique will be woven together as opposed to a part one, part two framework that we adopted for the first version of Ask.
Oh, that sounds like a wonderful idea. So, Ryan, I'm going to let you go, even though I could talk to you for quite some time about all sorts of things because you have such a wild intellect. You're very well socialized in the online world and business world, and you're a member of several masterminds. You've paid plenty of top-level experts, so you are a walking almanac. And it's been such a privilege and a pleasure to get you on a call. I know how valuable your time is. So I do want to thank you, especially on behalf of my audience who hear a lot about you, probably get emails from you, and hopefully going behind the scenes has given a little more insight into the human being, Ryan Levesque, you know, the person behind this brand and that journey that you've been through. So I'll put a link to a resource of yours. We'll work out what the most appropriate thing is. Anyone going to superfastbusiness.com can see on my very homepage is a chooser, a segmenter, and then the second layer is a segmenter. That came from me learning about this stuff and how it works at Ryan's event. One of the great privileges of teaching people is you get such a window into their world. Like when you had all those 23 businesses, you know, I'm constantly working with different businesses and you've always struck me as someone who's going to go a long way, and you haven't disappointed, Ryan. So thank you so much for sharing.
Well, I appreciate it. And this is my way of creating an excuse for us to connect at least, you know, a couple times a year like this to catch up. So it's always good to hear your voice, man. Miss our weekly calls. And it's good to connect again, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to share with your audience.
Well, if you'd like to come back and we could talk about other stuff too, you know, like marketing techniques, some business strategy ideas, you certainly have an open invitation. So hopefully we can make that happen.
Awesome.
There you go. You've been listening to superfastbusiness.com. That's Ryan Levesque, a very switched on individual. And go to episode 588 at superfastbusiness.com. Look for the episode Behind the Scenes. Brains with Ryan Levesque, and you'll be able to download some special resources that we make available.
Discover how to build your business
super fast.
Check out superfastbusiness.com.